It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 2nd of May 2015. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneiroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 2nd of May, I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Journalism from AUT University, Greg Treadwell, about the Prime Minister, the ponytail, and the press coverage that ensued. Then I spoke to opinionated Islander Alex Stone, speaking to him about his support for a marine reserve on Waiheke Island. Then I spoke to Carolyn Ogg, mother of Kavana Jade, the first child ambassador in New Zealand for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Now, over the last couple of weeks, for people interested not only in the news but the way that the news is reported, such as myself, it's been a fascinating time with this whole story of the Prime Minister and the ponytail. Now, that's an interesting story in itself, and we've seen that it's taken off around the world. But also what became a story was how that story was reported and the way that the New Zealand Herald went about getting the story. And then subsequently explaining how they'd got that story. And it raises a whole lot of issues around journalism. And we're lucky that on the island, one of our residents is a senior lecturer in journalism at AUT University. That's Greg Treadwell, also a former editor of the Gulf News. So welcome along, Greg.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning to all your listeners.
Great. I'll just get you to straighten up that microphone a little bit. There we go. So you must have been looking at this unfold and kind of having the time of your life.
Yeah, it's a deeply interesting case. And as a journalism academic, and I'd like to point out that's not a media studies academic. There is a difference. I'm absolutely fascinated by what happened, how it all ended up on the front page, how the Herald became the subject of the story itself when it was accused in a subsequent post by the waitress whose poor ponytail was the subject of John Key's attention. Her second post said that she had been duped into going on the record for the Herald. And, of course, the Herald on the Monday morning had a huge splash on the front page with the first story that named the waitress. And that in itself is a big ethical issue. Is it right to turn the eye of Sauron onto the complainant? Or to use another metaphor, you know, that as soon as we know who these complainants are, and effectively, in my view, she's a completely legitimate whistleblower, and whistleblowers need protection. And the Herald hasn't protected a whistleblower. They've, in fact, exposed her to the views of the Colosseum, if you like. So she's now, the sort of, as we know, the very, very common response of the crowd, if you like, is, oh, yeah, and how much part did she play? So that's not really the issue. The issue is the behaviour of the Prime Minister. So was it right for the Herald to bring to name her? It certainly wasn't right if she wasn't aware she was being interviewed, which is what her second blog post claimed.
So let's take a look at that. So, you know, a lot of people would say, well, you know, this involves the Prime Minister, so it's a story worth telling. In fact, she said herself, I felt like the country should know.
Yeah.
So, isn't it okay for a paper or a journalist to go poking around and go, well, I'm going to find out what's happening here?
Yeah, absolutely. That is exactly the right thing to do. But the wrong thing to do is to send the gossip columnist, who's an avowed and declared friend of the Prime Minister, who is at the subject of the story, to cover the story. It's that just from the beginning is the fundamental flaw in the whole of the Herald's approach. And there is still dispute around whether the Herald's disclosure was adequate. We're here to interview you for a story, and it's going to be on the front page tomorrow. And if that's not clear, then no legitimate interview's taking place. But the big problem was just not using its resources from the newsroom. Why it had to be the gossip columnist who did the story makes the whole thing smell very, very fishy. Why not send a news reporter who is, after all, a specialist in detachment, brings their own stuff to the story, always does. The idea of objective journalists is we're way past that idea. Nevertheless, there's still a huge value in detachment in journalism. And if you're not detached, i.e. if your friend is the Prime Minister who's involved in the story, if your brother, as I understand, is a partner or a shareholder of director of some sort, owner of the business under scrutiny, then you're exactly the wrong person to do the story. And we tell our students, and I do it regularly, yep, that's great that your mum's got this fantastic story, but we're going to have to give it to another student to cover because you're just too close.
So when you're teaching your students, what do you teach them about that introduction, that first, you know, the person's picked up the phone, what should they say to them?
Well, that's day one of the course, to be honest. Day one is how you represent yourself as a journalist. There are some rare and important moments where being undercover, if you like, as a journalist is not only acceptable, but deemed necessary. Very famous. My favourite of all is Nellie Bly, way back in the early 20th century, who went for Joseph Pulitzer, who was the editor of a paper in New York at the time. She went undercover, pretended she spent a few days in front of the mirror making weird faces at herself, and then went and got herself enrolled in a mental asylum, as they were known in those days, and exposed the horrific treatment that women in those places were subject to. That story can't be got unless you're not honest and you don't declare you're a journalist. But in any other, almost any other situation where a reporter is trying to get information from somebody, there are some very, very clear rules about declaring who you are and what your intentions with the information are. You've got to say who you are, where you work, and where it's likely to be published, except, as I say, in those rare cases when identifying yourself would kill the story.
So there must be a line there between, you know, I mean, there's some people, you know, as you've given an example there of where the only way that you can get the story is through subterfuge. There are, must be other examples where you believe that if the person identifies as a journalist, you won't get the story. But that doesn't always warrant then going through other means, does it?
No, exactly. That's a very good point. I mean, having said there are times when subterfuge is okay, that doesn't mean it's okay just because if I declare myself, I'll lose the story. That is not ethically okay at all. Sometimes you'll lose the story because you didn't go about it the right way. And when you declared yourself a journalist, they were not interested in talking to you at all, and that's just part of life.
So one of the things that people talk about as being a deciding factor in those situations is whether or not it's in the public interest.
Yeah.
Whether that warrants what would otherwise be a breach of privacy. And I think, you know, another example we've had recently is the Christchurch, you know, the case of the two people having sex in Christchurch who were filmed and put on social media. And there was a lot of debate around the subsequent coverage of that, where there was investigation into who those people were, what their relationships were with others, and the impact that exposure, well, excuse the pun, had on those relationships. And, you know, that seemed to me to cross a line. You know, okay, there might have been some prurient public interest in the fact that these two people did that and were seen and it, you know, got on Facebook. But the other bit about the investigation into who was, you know, the fiancé and the wife and what impact it had on them seemed
and
to go
the company.
Seemed to go well beyond public interest.
Yeah. A really important distinction is between what's in the public interest and what the public are interested in. They're two quite separate things. There's no doubt that the minutiae of the lives of celebrities, the public's interested in that. Celebrities grown as a news value over the last two decades exponentially. But it doesn't make it in the public interest. So first of all, the couple in the office in Christchurch, I think it was, wasn't it? The public are interested in that. We all have this kind of want to mock and tease those people who have made huge mistakes and exposed themselves somehow. Again, pun. But that doesn't make it in the public interest. It's the public's interested in it, so it's all over social media, and the mainstream media is then absolutely tempted by this story, and the mainstream media argument goes, it's out there already, it's on social media, so what are we doing except formalizing a story that's already going around? So that is not necessarily in the public interest, though, and I think one of the great distinctions that today's media has to make is that it works in the public interest and not just on what the public's interested in, because that today is very much the realm of social media. So
But in the ponytail case, because it involves the Prime Minister, that pretty much does define public interest, doesn't it? Because it's the Prime Minister.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We have every right to have great interest, public interest, not just be interested in, but have legitimate public interest in a democratic sense in the behaviour of our leaders. That's absolutely critical. When we can't examine the behaviour of our leaders, then the government is no longer run by the people.
And there could have been a front page story on that, where a journalist contacted the cafe owners and the woman, the waitress, and said, we want to do a story for the Herald, and one or some of them may have said yes or may have said no, but there still would have been enough there to run a story on it, presumably.
Yeah, I think the Herald got blinded by the scoop. I thought they were over-anxious to get to be the first news organisation to name the waitress. I don't think that was a difficult thing to do. I think that wouldn't have been difficult to discover. It's well known where John Key goes for Sunday morning brunch. So you could have found out the name of the waitress. The decision is, are you easily, the decision is now, are you going to publish it? And that's the bigger call. And they decided to call to publish it, even though, according to Martin Bradbury, whose blog her statements appeared on, he called the Herald at 8 minutes past 11 and declared that she withdrew all her comments.
Now, that's interesting as well, isn't it? I want to talk about this, you know, because people, I think, look at that and say, well, obviously there's different things, and we'll come to that, you know, the ones who say, oh, this is just all a beat up, and in some ways kind of a re-victimisation of the waitress in many ways, but, you know, we'll come to that. But when, you know, some people look at it and go, well, look, she said she didn't want to be quoted in the paper, and they quoted her anyway.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, does a person who's interviewed have the right to withdraw comments?
It's completely understandable that the public feels, if the Herald was given the was told that she withdrew her comments and the rights to use her image, and went ahead against that wish anyway, that the Herald was somehow outside ethics, behaving in a completely unacceptable way, trashing the interests of an individual for the scoop on their front page, and you can see how the public sees how they perceive that the behaviour of the Herald is entirely unacceptable. It's not that simple. There are times as an editor when you have asked somebody, or one of your reporting staff have asked somebody for an interview, and that person has agreed to it, they've been interviewed, the information they've given has been recorded and it's been prepared for press, and not only that, or for publication, and not only that, but other people have been asked for their views on the same story. There comes a point where you can't allow people just to take what they've told you on the record suddenly off the record. If you did that, if it was up to the source every time publication happened, whether that publication should go ahead, that means every interviewee can say whatever they want and then have a period afterwards which they can reflect on and decide which bits they've said should go to press. Now, which bits people have said, which bits go to publication, is the job of the reporter and the editor, not the source. So if you can imagine self-promoting politicians reconsidering what they told a reporter at 10 o'clock at 10:30 and then ringing the radio station saying, oh, what I told you before you can't use, then the media becomes the plaything of the powerful, and we don't. The media needs it to be able to stand on its own rights. Editors need to be able to say, I'm sorry you told us that on the record. We are going with the story. You can't change your mind and withdraw. That isn't to say that editors don't have a human side as well, and will allow people, when it's not in a matter of great public interest, to withdraw stuff or change their minds. Or journalists are told in general not to go back to the source before publication to have the accuracy of the story checked. And that, again, to the public might seem mad, but you can imagine what it's like when you go back to a source and say, this is what I've written after I talked to you. The source then starts rewriting your story, changing it to their angle, pushing down the views of other people. It's just journalists are independent, or they're not independent, and they must be entirely independent. So, yes, actually, editors do have the right to say, you can't withdraw the comments you made at 10 o'clock this morning. Now, whether that was what the Herald was doing in this case or not, it's not entirely clear. But if you were to take the editor's point of view for a moment and assume that he was completely of the belief that all three sources, the two cafe owners and the waitress, were completely clear that they were being interviewed for a Herald story, and then at 11 o'clock at night, just before the paper went to bed, one source suddenly pulls everything, you just can't allow that to happen. So if that was the case, perhaps the editor of the Herald isn't at fault here. Clearly somebody was at fault, because the waitress, Amanda Bailey, her name is, she sort of has become this iconic thing, the waitress. Mm. She's much more than a waitress. I assume she's probably a university student and a friend and a daughter, but she's become the waitress. If the waitress was not, as is clear, was not, did not understand she was being interviewed for the Herald, then somebody has let her down extremely badly. It's not necessarily the editor of the Herald, although unless you're actually in the newsroom that night at 10:30, 11 o'clock, you'll never know.
So when someone feels that they've been wronged by the media, you know, I don't know, duped into giving a statement that they wouldn't have given if they'd known it was for the Herald, for example, what recourse do they have?
Well, they can go to the Press Council. Now, not every publication is subject to the authority of the Press Council. The Press Council is a self-regulating body. So the Press Council, while the people who sit on the council aren't all journalists, it is essentially an industry body. There are representatives of the public on the Press Council, and the chair is always a retired High Court judge or somebody of that position. And it is, in my view, people who have not been felt that they've been well heard by the Press Council might disagree. But in my view, it's a pretty robust and good body, full of people who think very carefully about the public interest and the rights of journalists. So you can go to the Press Council, but you can only go to the Press Council after you've complained to the publication first. And if you're still unhappy with the publication's response to your complaint, you can go to the Press Council. Now, there is the Press Council has a code of ethics. It's got 12 points, everything from privacy to photography. In my view, it's well overdue for a rewrite, but that's a completely other story. There are 12 points of ethical principles in the Code of Ethics, and if you feel any of them's been breached by a publication, your recourse is to first go to the publication with your complaint, and if you're still not happy, then you can go directly to the Press Council. The Press Council will consider your will ask for the other side of the story from the newspaper, will consider both sides of the stories and make a ruling. If your complaint is upheld, then the Press Council can insist that the full decision is published by the publication, the full decision of the Press Council airing your grievance and their agreement with it. If your decision isn't upheld, then the newspaper may or may not, according to how it chooses, publish the decision that's in their favour.
Yeah. So I'm talking to Greg Tribwell, journalism lecturer, and we're talking about the recent Prime Minister ponytail pulling story and how that's been covered in the media. I suppose two other things that have happened, you know, we've just been talking about how the Herald got the story, but I think two other things flow from this that throw some light on some trends in journalism. And they're both kind of the two different ways that the story has been talked about since it occurred. One, I think, is the increasing phenomena of weird news. And we've seen the story reported, maybe not so much in New Zealand, but around the world in that kind of weird news category that kind of seems to kind of be taking over from the cat up a tree story. And then the other thing is the vitriolic opinion parading as news, which we've seen more of at home. Two trends that seem to be on the rise in news. And I wondered if you want to, you choose one to start off with.
Well, I think they're both really good points. The overseas coverage, people are given to positions of power, as John Key has, and we all know he's in his third term now. So for us, he's a kind of part of the wallpaper. But for overseas people, it's like, how did this weird guy who pulls ponytails become the Prime Minister? That's actually the news value. So It may even be completely unfair on John Key. I mean, whether you agree with him or not, he's done a lot more as Prime Minister than Paul Ponytail. So it does, unfortunately, become the odd angle. Now, every news page, every double page spread in a newspaper, every bulletin, every TV thing, I'm sure people are aware of this, that the media uses these things called brighteners. So you can't just have a double-page spread of gloomy, awful news, although people feel that's what they're assaulted by every day mostly, that perhaps they don't notice the brightness. But in most double-page spreads or in most bulletins, there'll be a little piece of dog up, cat up a tree, or dog can go surfing, or, you know, those brighteners. And I wonder, in fact, if John Key overseas isn't something of a brightener. Look how weird they are down the bottom end of the world. It's that kind of angle. Yeah, but we do. That does affect us, our reputation as a nation. We do become something of the laughingstock of the world for a brief time. I was quite blown away by, I guess we're slightly off the media here, but how he stepped from being the ridicule of the world into being into giving speeches in Saudi Arabia and meeting the king, and what the king must have thought. I mean, I guess the king of Saudi Arabia did a quick Google before John Key arrived, and oh yeah, New Zealand next day. I wonder what this guy's like. Oh.
Yeah, bad treatment of women, not so much of an issue in Saudi Arabia.
Maybe not. No, maybe not. And in fact, I would urge readers to find, listeners to find Patrick Gower's piece on the TV3 website about his experiences travelling to Saudi Arabia as part of John Key's entourage. A very interesting piece. He was obviously felt quite pent up and oppressed there, and when he came back, he's let loose in an opinion piece on the TV3 website, well worth reading.
Mm. So, well, let's just touch on briefly the other element, which is this kind of, you know, opinion as news,
yeah.
And I suppose the proponents of it that have got the highest profile are Paul Henry and Mike Hosking.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Paul Henry's talked about this. I mean, to be honest, I don't watch either. But Mike Hosking's comments on it certainly were widely reported beyond his own show. And he's someone who now says, whether it's to kind of give himself some kind of out, says he's not a journalist. But you know, this kind of thing of you know, new opinion is news is on the rise, isn't it?
It certainly is, and I don't think that people who lead current affairs shows, no matter how light and frothy and flexible they are, can suddenly choose whether they're a journalist or not. It doesn't suit them to be a journalist this week. Next week it probably will. I think that all those opinion leading figures, whether they be the editorial writers in a newsroom for a newspaper, who are also opinion writers and, in a sense, opinion leaders within the community, they all have, even though they're writing their own opinion, it's built on a solid base of journalism all around them. And so it's an informed opinion that has... And once upon a time, there weren't even names attributed to editorials because it was said to be the view of the newspaper or the radio station even. So you had a kind of... tacit agreement amongst all the people that this was the view, all the people who worked for the newspaper, that this was the view of the newspaper. It's so different now. It's so different now. He doesn't have to justify anything. He doesn't have to show any evidence. He rants and raves, and this is Mike Hosking I'm talking about. I don't think Paul Henry's very different, but they're kind of different creatures. Somebody said to me the other day, it'd all be great if we could just get Campbell onto state-owned television and Hosking onto TV3, and then everything would be fine. But it is certainly a trend that it. But opinion isn't a new trend from news organisations. That's been going on since the first press barons bought their newspapers in the early 19th century. So it's not opinion. In fact, when newspapers started, they were mostly about opinion. The concept of impartiality only developed much later. So opinion's always been part of news. But there's research-based opinion, and then there's idiotic rant.
Mm. And that seems to be where we're going.
Yeah.
So, and actually, it is where we're going, because very, very soon we're going to have the Opinionated Islanders in here, and that pretty much sums up their show, their slot.
Morning, Alex.
Yeah. So, look, Greg, it's been great talking to you and fascinating and nice to have those insights. I think it brings in, you know, some issues to consider there, which perhaps you know, don't get a lot of thinking about beyond that kind of initial reaction. Which does seem to be a fairly polarised reaction depending on people's political affiliations. But
I think just one last thought is that the media has very much itself to blame for many, many decades of not being entirely transparent itself about how it works for its own advantage. And now people make some reasonable assumptions about the media, but they aren't properly informed about some of the subtleties and technical issues around the ethics of journalism. So the more we know about how our journalists operate, then the better we are to judge whether they're doing a good job or not.
Yeah, and you've got a nice case study for your classes now.
Yeah,
as well.
We've been talking about it for a fortnight.
Great, thanks very
much. Thanks, Chris. Cheers.
Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues. Brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by The Village Butchery, the place to go for fine cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues. Here on Waiheke Radio every Saturday morning from 10 a.m.
Yeah, I'm your host, Chris Walker, through until noon today. It's the first Saturday of the month, and we should be talking to the opinionated islanders. We've only got one of them here. One of them seems to be waylaid and missing in action, but Alex is here. How are you, Alex?
Hi, I'm here, yes. I'm just wondering if Alan has been waylaid by the glorious weather, as you described it, but it's no good for sailing. 5 knots is not my kind of sailing.
No. So you're going to be a landlubber this weekend.
Looks like I've got two options. I can go sailing or I can clean out the garage.
Well, you know, if you get out there, you can just kind of go out for a bit of a rest and just sit around. And I once went on a 24-hour sailing race in Otago Harbour, and you know, probably about this time of year. And if you're familiar with Otago Harbour at all, about this time of year, what you find is from about 10 o'clock at night through to about 10 o'clock in the morning, there is no wind. It just dies right down, especially in the middle of the night. And the idea of this race was you'd see how many rounds of the course you could do in 24 hours, and you could swap crews. So I always used to volunteer for the shift from 2 in the morning, because we knew we'd just get out there
and sit there,
take a thermos of coffee, sit there. You know, moon was out. And just glorious, just float around in the completely still harbour.
In those the moments you wonder how sailing can be called a sport. It's more of a philosophical exercise.
Yeah, it definitely was. It definitely was. And we'd take the transistor radio. And,
oh, fantastic.
Yeah, just a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it'd be like that tonight, as you moon out, sitting there, nothing happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, well, that was an interesting interview with Greg just earlier.
No, I thought of you because I thought, well, no doubt, you know, this whole, I know that, you know, the way that the news is reported is something that vexes you, and
yeah,
I know that the Prime Minister vexes you too, so that's right up your alley.
Yeah, and I've been watching with as much interest as Greg the way the Herald has handled this story, and it has covered itself in something that is not glory. They've made a real hash of it. Not very impressive at all. Yeah, and there seems to be a kind of disturbing amorality and quite a few elements to the story. The way the owners of the cafe served up their staff member, who they should have been protecting, they served her up to a gossip columnist, a really nasty gossip columnist. Not very nice at all. Yeah.
Yeah,
anyway,
it was an interesting one, actually, wasn't it? Seeing that, you know, the gossip columnist, as you say, with the front page story, very, very unusual.
And how the front page story has disappeared. The Herald has not touched that story since. After they changed their story, the night after the front page story, they ran three different versions of a rationalization for the Glucina entrapment. And that's kind of unprecedented. The Herald ran on their online a version of the newspaper. They started at about 11 o'clock that night with one version of their rationalization for Glucina's entrapment, and they said she didn't do it. And then they removed that element from their press release because it was obvious that she did, and they didn't want to obviously get into a situation where they'd have to defend that. And so they changed their story twice during the night. So, you know, the third version was the one that stayed online the next morning, but nothing has appeared in print since then.
Yeah.
So it was a big enough story to be full page, front page one day, have three different versions of an explanation overnight, and then nothing. Apart from a column by Bob Jones, which started off with a rape joke, you know, so not very splendid at all, you know.
Yeah. But no, we might take advantage of the fact that Alan's not here. We can subject you to some serious journalism yourself.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you're up for it, I haven't given you any notice of this, so just letting you know I'm from Waiheke Radio, and I'd like to talk to you about the proposed marine reserve, and whatever you say will be broadcast on the radio. Have we got that clear?
Yeah. thank you. We have got it clear.
Yeah. So, I mean, that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, the marine reserve actually seems to have gone quiet. So
it hasn't. It hasn't. The people of Waiheke will be getting a survey in their mailboxes on Monday. It'll be posted on Monday, the 4th of May. The survey is being managed by the local board, because in their three-year plan, the local board had waterways protection as their top priority. It slipped a bit in their priority list in their 10-year plan, but anyway, they still have. I think we're all clear that the local board has quite a strong environmental ethos, and they wanted to cut through the debate about the marine reserve idea, or the idea for greater marine protection in the Gulf, in the waters around Waiheke. So they are putting out this survey. The survey is as good as it can be, although I haven't seen it. But I understand it's been very well put together by Colmar Brunton. And the survey that comes in the mail will be mailed to Waiheke residents and ratepayers. So if you're living in Remuera and pay the rates for a batch on Waiheke, you'll get your survey. And it will also be sent to high school kids, which I think is a great thing. And it will also be available online, which I think is a little concerning, in that online surveys, it's more difficult to ensure that you don't get double ups and so on. But I understand that Colmar Brunton will be the official analysis of the survey will only be from the mailed out ones. So we should get a fairly good indication of where Waiheke Islanders stand on the situation, just what their values are, and I think the board is great. The board has actually got quite an expansive vision. They're talking about an entire network of marine reserves throughout the Waiheke ward, which is good logic, because we all know that reserves work. The three foundations to making marine reserves work. One is they have to be representative of the habitat. The second one is they have to be replicated, so you have to have a few marine reserves of the same habitat. And the third one is they have to be in an integrated network where the network itself is big enough to support a functioning ecosystem if everything else collapses around it. So I think the board are doing great things, yeah. So the marine reserve is... the idea is alive and well, yeah.
So the last time I think we talked about this, there was talk of, maybe the board, you can correct me here, that they were doing some more, you know, people were saying, well, there needs to be some more research about what are the best areas, what's going to be the most beneficial for marine life.
Absolutely.
Has that work been carried out?
Yes and no. The Friends of the Hauraki Golf Group, who are the crowd that initially came up with the initiative to look for greater marine protection along the northern coastline of Waiheke. As I say, it's been expanded a bit by the board. They're talking about the entire Waiheke ward. The Friends group, when they started the project, said we would only look at a debate about location once three surveys had been done. The first survey was a habitat survey, which has been done, which is knowing exactly what's under the water in terms of just the geography under the water, where there's a mud bottom or where there's a rocky bottom, etc. That's been done for the entire northern coastline. The second survey was to be a credible social science survey of attitudes, which the board is doing now. And the third survey that's yet to be done is a biological assessment of what's actually living there, because you use that as a baseline to understand how the biodiversity might grow. It would also give you an indication of what rare species might be there. That third survey was the expensive one, and we're still seeking money for that. And only after those three surveys have been done and the information collated, only then could we realistically look at a sort of a more specific debate about location. Yeah.
So given that the third part of that hasn't been completed, isn't the local board survey, which you've just been talking about, premature?
No, not at all. It's more of an attitudinal thing, just seeing what people feel about it. The biological survey is getting down to some kind of specific short strokes, you know, and marine biologists would say, "Oh, this," that would get, the biological survey would get us closer to the location debate, because the biologist would say, "Oh, here's an interesting area because I don't know, there's deep water with a range of seaweeds, or here there are rare species in this particular spot," or whatever. That's when you're getting down to the short strokes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think certainly hasn't gone entirely quiet. It's just there's a lot of work behind the scenes. Yeah. Yeah. And
so is it hoped that that third part of the survey will be completed?
We had hoped it could be done last year, but we couldn't raise the funding for it. So if there's an eccentric millionaire out there with $40,000, that's what it needs. We had asked the there's a unit within the Auckland Council called the Research and Investigations Monitoring Unit, REMU. We asked them formally twice through the Waiheke Local Board to do that work, and they haven't come up with it. So our only option is to find the money through some kind of grant and engage the scientists. One option is the Department of Conservation has a sort of community projects grant funding round in May, in June, ASB Trust, those kind of places might give us the money. Yeah. The other option is within the Sea Change Project, they might advance that particular study.
So what happens if the survey comes back and the people of Waiheke say, "Not in my backyard"?
It just means we'll have more work to do to convince the people that it is a good idea, because it certainly is a good idea. And you're right, it's an awkward position to be in. You know, it sounds a difficult thing to preach to people that they don't understand. But the evidence behind the need for greater marine protection in the Gulf is overwhelming and irrefutable. So we just have to carry on with that. My impression is that the people of Waiheke will come forward and say, yes, we should do it. There may be concerns about specific locations, but they will go for a need. They will understand the need for greater marine protection. Even the opponents to the marine reserve have said, and I quote, "Their opposition is in location only." And I'm quoting from their submission to a select committee to Parliament about 2-3 weeks ago. I had to fly to Wellington to make a submission to the local government select committee at Parliament, because the opposition campaign had sent a submission to Parliament and it needed to be discussed by the select committee.
Yeah. The number of signatories to that petition and the fact that it got there must worry you somewhat, though, that there is actually a high level of opposition to this.
I think the petition is deeply flawed, and that was part of our submission, though not the main part of our submission. They got 2,500 signatures, but the petition was analysed by an independent party, and that person found that about a third, just slightly less than a third, were Waiheke residents. So if that's the case, we're talking about 600 people, 800 people in a population of 8,000. And on top of that, the supporting material for the petition was simply false. They made three or four claims in big adverts in the newspaper, which are simply untrue. And the biggest one was, I think the one that would have affected most people was the issue of walking dogs on the beaches. Mm. The opposition campaign said that dogs cannot be walked on beaches that adjoin marine reserves. That's simply not true. There are about 8 marine reserves in New Zealand, including one on Waiheke, where dogs are allowed to walk on the beaches adjoining. So it's just not true.
And I should point out as well that just around that, I have actually spoken to people from, you know, the opposition campaign about that very issue. And you know, they acknowledged it, actually. They said, well, yes, but it could happen. And so there does appear, you know, to be, certainly in my conversations with them on that issue, they have taken a different stance than what they were doing in their advertising. But yeah, the advertising didn't change.
Yeah, the advertising wouldn't stand up, and advertising standards authorities would, those ads wouldn't stand anymore. But my going back to your earlier question is, am I concerned about the people who signed that petition? Of course we are, but I think a lot of them might have signed with a false impression, yeah, about the dogs in particular. So we're not sure how many people signed with full information, yeah. But it's awkward to get into a sort of a little a diversion like that, because the bigger issue doesn't go away. We need to take a serious look at greater conservation of the Gulf's resources. That's just obvious. It has to be done. And the board, the local board, to their credit, are taking that quite seriously. The reason for the local board's doing the survey right now is to try get it in. The results of the survey will be fed into all the decision making around the sea change project, which is leading towards a marine spatial plan for the entire Gulf. The sea change project is going to kind of close off its input in June this year, so the Waiheke survey can be included into their considerations, and then the sea change plan will be made public in September this year. And all indications are that the sea change plan will have a recommendation for at least 10% of the Gulf in marine reserves, and at the moment only 0.3% is. So, so I think it's likely that there will be an impetus for more marine reserves. We've just got to decide where they go. Yeah. And that's the usual story, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for that update, Alex.
Yeah, so that's where we're at.
Yeah, so Alex is a representative of the group who are proposing a marine reserve, and specifically proposing one that kind of encompasses that kind of enclosure, Sandy Bay area.
No,
that's favourite area.
That's where we are misquoted all the time. Our initiative was for a marine reserve somewhere along the northern coastline. Yeah. And that's why in the habitat survey we commissioned, the habitat survey looked at the entire northern nine zones along the northern coastline from Ofanaki to Gannett Rock. And as I said, the board has maybe got a more expansive vision. They're looking at a network of marine reserves throughout the Waiheke ward. Mm-hmm. So in that network, I'm sure one of them would be along the northern coastline. Yeah.
Great. Okay, yeah. Thanks very much, Alex.
Yeah, no problem.
And hopefully next month we can bring you back the Opinionated Islanders, and we'll...
We look forward to that. Well. Yeah, there's always opinion on this island, eh?
There sure is.
Yeah.
There sure is.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
I've got with me now Carolyn Ogg, who is the mother of Kavana Jade. And Kavana's pretty well known around the island, but she's just got herself involved with the Make-A-Wish. She's the first child ambassador for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Is that the right name there, Carolyn?
Yes, in New Zealand.
Oh, sorry, I'll turn you on. Yeah, first child ambassador for the Make-A-Wish Foundation in New Zealand.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, so how did Kavana come to be involved with that?
Late last year, Kavana's wish got granted through Make-A-Wish New Zealand. Her wish was to go to the Gold Coast of Australia. And when she came back on her bucket list that she created a couple of years ago, she wanted to become an ambassador for a charity that she was involved in. And so she fell in love with Make-A-Wish, and it's just evolved from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, Kavana, I mean, for people who aren't familiar with Kavana and her story, do you want to just kind of give us in a nutshell, you know, what's going on with her?
Great. Kavana was born with upper respiratory lung disease, and over the last she's turning 16 in August. Over the last 16 years, she's had complications and lots of hospital admissions into Starship. Last year, she started a drug called Zolia, which we fundraised for over the last 2 years, and it's made a great difference to her quality of life. So she's able to be what she calls a normal teenager now, socialise, be able to attend school again. And so we're continuing to fundraise for that. But along the way, Kavana's joined up with Make-A-Wish. So her role is to help create wishes come true for other chronically ill children in New Zealand, working with Make-A-Wish New Zealand.
So what did it mean for her to have her wish granted?
She was overjoyed. It was such a special occasion for her. She waited 2 years for her wish to be granted. So in between hospital admissions, that's what was getting her through, the strength to get through her hospital admission. So there was hope at the end and joy that she was able to actually go to the Gold Coast. And that's what she wants to do for other children.
Yeah. So she's taken on an ambassador's role. What's involved with that?
That is going around and talking at conferences, promoting Make-A-Wish New Zealand. We've got this I Wish I Was Day coming up on the 8th of May, which is where you get to let your imagination run free and you get to dress up as who you want to be or who you wanted to be when you were older. We're asking local businesses and schools to get behind us. Kavana will be going to 10 schools next Friday, or this Friday, the 8th of May, dressed up as what she wanted to become, and gets to talk in assemblies and to schools and businesses about how you can support Make-A-Wish and help grant another wish, because right now Make-A-Wish only is able to grant 200 wishes a year, but we have between 350 to 400 children actually needing wishes to be granted.
Yeah. So that must take a bit of a toll on Kavana, all that, you know, running around and talking in us. And I think, you know, there must be a bit of an impact on the old nerves and stuff as well.
She's loving it. It's right where she wants to be right now. She's giving back to the community, which is something she's always wanted to do. Nerves? Yes, definitely. 2 weeks ago, she had to do her first conference in front of 260 people. She was nervous. She had to get up and speak for, I think it was about 2 minutes her speech had to go for. She got through it, and at the end, she had a standing ovation, which was just amazing. And the feeling that she experienced after that was, this is why I get to do it, because she gets something out of it, but she's also giving back and helping people support Make-A-Wish through it.
Great. So the whole purpose of this is to raise awareness of the Make-A-Wish Foundation and presumably to get more donations coming through. So people will dress up and they make a donation along with their dressing up. Is that how it works?
Yes. So basically we're asking schools or businesses to participate by dressing up on the 8th of May just for a gold coin donation. And all that money will go back to Make-A-Wish New Zealand to help grant wishes for chronically sick children.
Yeah, and she's visiting a couple of schools on the island along those lines as well, isn't she?
Yes, hopefully we're trying to approach two schools on Thursday before Friday, when she'll go over to Auckland and approach 10 schools and businesses over there.
Yeah. Oh, great. Oh, well, good luck with that.
And thank you.
Yeah, Kavana couldn't. We did ask her to come, but she couldn't come today. So hence Carolyn being here. But thanks very much for stepping in and letting that know. And if people want to find out more, what's the easiest way to do that?
They can find out more information by going to the Make-A-Wish website, which is www.makeawish.org.nz, or they can private message me on Facebook.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onioroa.